program titled The Privacy Road Ahead, the California Consumer Privacy Act and Strategic Planning for 2019. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. To receive CLE credit for today's webinar, New York licensed attorneys attending remotely are required to prove attendance by recording a verification code on the form that has been provided to you. You can find this form and a copy of today's PowerPoint under the Handouts tab located on the left-hand side of your screen. A code will be read toward the middle of the webinar. Please record this code on the remote CLE verification form. Please note, if the number is missing from the New York affirmation form, CLE credit cannot be issued. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our hosts for today's call, Rachel Marmore and Alex Reynolds. Alex, you may begin.
Thanks so much. Welcome, everybody. It's great to have you here. You're with us on the Privacy Road Ahead, the California Consumer Privacy Act and Strategic Planning for 2019. We're going to be going through a lot of information, so let me jump right into it here. First, for our agenda, we have some broad items, but they're going to be quite deep. There's a lot of conversation we need to have about this statute because it is very complex. So we're going to go through some key takeaways that we'd like you to keep in mind throughout the presentation. Then we're going to have to take a bit of a deep dive into the CCPA text itself. And I know that's probably not the most exciting thing in the world, but it really is important to have a strong grasp of what's going on with the statute so that what we talk about in terms of its effects makes sense to you later on. We also want to talk specifically about the way that the CCPA interacts with the GDPR, because we know that many of you have been trying to comply with the GDPR for a long time now, and we want to talk about what we can leverage from that process that may be applicable to the CCPA. Then we'll dive into some application and hypotheticals, and then as we kind of glibly say here, we're going to prep for doomsday. What do you have to do in 2019 that will put you in a good position for the statutory implementation date on January 1st, 2020. So I'm Alex Reynolds. I am an associate in the Washington, D.C. office of Davis Wright Tremaine, and for the past year, my life has been really just focused on the GDPR and GDPR implementation. So I will be happy to talk to you today about how you can leverage that for CCPA purposes.
And I'm Rachel Marmore. I'm a counsel in our New York office, joined Davis Wright Tremaine at the beginning of this year. My background is equally in law firms and working in-house in a financial institution. Here at Davis Wright Tremaine, what I've been working mainly on is working with some of our large-scale organizations to build out their enterprise compliance program, trying to leverage some of my experience working in policies and working in the data management space to help clients get their heads around what they need to do to be compliant with some of the newer obligations. Alex is going to launch into the substance of our presentation in just a second. I'll just add, please do try to send us questions as we go along if you have them. We might exercise some discretion about if they are big picture questions, we might save them till the end. If there's concepts that we're not explaining clearly, we do want to try to address those in real time so that people can follow along with us.
Thanks, Rachel. Yes, and I would echo that sentiment. So let's dive into the substance. So a few key takeaways, and these are things that we're going to reiterate throughout the presentation. and some key themes here. So first, the definition of personal information in the CCPA is incredibly broad, really one of the broadest that's been written into a privacy law, and even broader than the GDPR. So it's really important to understand what is the scope that the CCPA captures within your organization, given this broader definition of personal information. Second, consumer obligations are the new reality. The GDPR contains the consumer rights, access, right to be forgotten, certain opt-out rights, portability, and the CCPA follows directly from that, giving consumers a right to access, delete, and opt out, even though they're somewhat different than the GDPR obligations. So that's going to be a main focus of CCPA compliance. And then third, having an accurate map of data sources is going to be incredibly important, because that's the way that you're going to be able to effectuate those consumer obligations and have accurate disclosures where you need those. So going into the CCPA itself, we've given you a citation there so you can find it. As a little bit of background, the CCPA was passed in June 2018 basically to prevent a ballot initiative, a very similar proposed statute, but one that was, I think it's fair to say, even stricter than the language that we got in the law that was passed. It will become effective January 1st, 2020, and then there's going to be a little bit of lag time, and this is kind of an interesting procedural aspect of the statute. The black letter law of the CCPA becomes effective January 1st, 2020, so there's no implementation lag time. However, there is an enforcement lag time. The AG will not enforce it for 6 months. Complicating that scenario, however, is that the AG is required to promulgate certain rules that address certain aspects of the statute, things like, you know, what is sufficient notice, what do you do for opt-out, so on and so forth. And those rules will become effective on July 1st, 2020, or before it, depending on how the AG is able to get public comment on those rules. So as we go through 2019, as we go through the first part of 2020, it's going to be important to be agile and looking closely at what the AG has to say about this. So what entities are covered? What are we talking about in terms of the broad scope here? We're going to be talking about this a lot. Basically, the CCPA applies to California businesses doing business in California and processing the personal information of California residents. Now, the definition of the term resident is specifically defined by reference to another part of the California Code of Regulations, and I'll read part of it out to you because it's important and it kind of illustrates how broad it is. So the term resident as defined in the law includes every individual who is in the state for other than a temporary or transitory purpose, and every individual who is domiciled in the state who is outside of the state for a temporary or transitory purpose. Other individuals are non-residents. So as you can see, it's not just about physically being in California. In fact, the definition comes from part of the California regulations having to do with the application of taxes. So it is difficult to effectively separate a database of California individuals from a database of residents of other states. So equally important is the definition of business. We have seen some misconceptions about what is included in a business, so we want to clarify that. First, it's for-profit entities only, so nonprofits are going to be excluded from this definition. Business includes any same branded or controlled or controlling company. So there are two important elements here. the business incorporates into the definition another entity that the business is controlled by or is controlled, so it has like 51% voting share or has controlling authority over that business, and is same branded. So it has the same service mark or trademark. And those two aspects of the definition create some what I'll characterize as fairly interesting scenarios that we're going to get to, and we'll show you a diagram a little bit later in the presentation. But suffice it to say, it's really important to have the org chart in front of you when you're doing CCPA compliance. I was joking to Rachel a little bit earlier today that you could call it the California Org Chart Act or the California Database Cleanup Act, because it really does require a granular look at what the structure of a business is in order to map the data flows and, importantly, where the opt-out right could apply. And then the definition has a third important element, which is the minimum requirements to become a business. So it's any one of the three things that you see at the bottom right of the slide. The gross revenue is more than $25 million. The business receives or shares personal information of more than 50,000 consumers, households, or devices, more on that in a second, or the business receives more than 50% of its annual income from the sale of personal information. Focusing on that 50,000 number for a moment, consumers, households, or devices, that is a very easy threshold to cross, and that's the only threshold that you need to cross in order to meet the minimum requirements for a business. So it's any one of these three things. So that actually works out to 137 unique hits on a website per day for a year, which is very, very few. And as databases go, 50,000 the records of 50,000 individuals is relatively small. Notice that it says or devices, and the way that the statute's written, the devices don't even need to be devices of California residents. They can be devices themselves. And device information under the definition of personal information is considered to identify an individual. So a very easy threshold to meet. A little bit more about the scope here. Understanding who is a business is very important. It's also very important to understand who's a service provider and who's a third party, because those relationships have a special meaning and are relevant to when the consumer right of opt-out applies. A service provider has three elements. There has, as between the business and service provider, the service provider has to be processing information for a business purpose. It has to be processing on behalf of the business that it's contracted with, and there has to be a contract that prohibits the service provider from making what we summarize here as secondary use of the data. So it can't process the data for its own purposes. This is a similar concept to controller processor in GDPR. But a key difference here is that you don't have to set up the service provider relationship. The significance of being a service provider is that the opt-out right doesn't apply as between the business and you as a service provider. So that has certain advantages that we'll talk a little bit more about. But you have to be very careful when you set that relationship up because of these three elements and the prohibition on secondary use of the data. And then finally, third party is defined as what it is not in the statute. And basically, when you have a transfer of personal information from a business to a third party, it's necessary to determine whether that falls within the definition of a sale, again, because of the opt-out right. So business, service provider, and third party, those are three entities that you need to pay attention to for CCPA compliance. And then, importantly, there are some out-of-scope entities as well. And again, there have been some misconceptions here about the nature or the scope of these opt-outs. I know that we have members of our audience today who are going to be very interested in this. So medical information that's covered by HIPAA and the California equivalent, providers of healthcare services and clinical trials are going to be exempt from the CCPA. But I would caveat that it's a very broad exemption for medical providers. So a lot of personal information is not going to be within scope. But the CCPA does leave a window open for data that is not protected health information and does not have HIPAA controls applied to it to be within the scope of the CCPA. So those of you in the healthcare industry do have some work to do in order to identify which data sets are within or outside of the scope of the CCPA and proceed from there. Other out-of-scope information would be information used to generate consumer reports under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, information under the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, and then the information covered by Gramm-Leach-Bliley or its California equivalent. And once again, it's not that entities that are subject to the GLBA are out of scope. It's that the information covered by the GLBA is out of scope. To the extent that you have a business with a mixed set of information, CCPA is still going to apply. Okay, diving into the definition of personal information itself, you can see at the top right corner we have a portion of the definition from the statute. And a couple of things I want to go over here. Again, definition is very broad. It's going to include by themselves unique identifiers. Those are defined as internet protocol addresses, cookie unique IDs, so on and so forth. Personal information does not include de-identified or anonymized information. The problem is that what's anonymized or what is properly de-identified so that it is outside the scope of the CCPA is very difficult to determine. The CCPA does not have a clear-cut line between de-identified information and personal information. And the fact that the definition is so broad and includes strings of data that are by themselves personal information, you have to evaluate a data set very carefully to determine whether any of that data is going to be associated with an individual. So it's going to require a close look if you intend to rely on an argument that you're not subject to it because your data set is de-identified. It also excludes publicly available information, but only to the extent that that information is part of government records. We have a definition of consumer and unique identifier there on the right-hand side. I would just highlight that the definition of consumer is broad enough to capture employees as well. So we're not just talking about consumers, third parties that you have relationships with, but your employees too. And there is no exception for business contacts. So an individual in their personal capacity and an individual in their business capacity are one and the same thing. One final thing that I want to show you, but I won't talk through, this is more for your kind of take-home reference, is looking at the CCPA versus other similar definitions of personal information and the fact that it is so much more, I guess I'll say, comprehensive, including things like probabilistic information or information that probabilistically identifies an individual and information about a household. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Rachel to talk to you about the consumer rights.
Sure. Alex, looks like we had a few questions about the definition of business, so I can try to walk through those quickly before we move on, just so people have that understanding about whether the law might apply to their organizations. The three criteria that Alex mentioned previously are or criteria, not and. So if you meet any one of those criteria, then you would be subject to the law. In terms of what makes a business doing business in California, unfortunately, the law does not provide any guidance on that. There is a definition in California tax law for the purpose of a business having to file taxes in California that has certain income thresholds. I don't know that that will apply to this or not. We don't really have any guidance here. I think there are some issues with it being applied too broadly, that there might be a constitutional challenge as to what it means to do business in California. But my best guess is that the constitutional definition for personal jurisdiction is what's going to matter here. And if a court can get jurisdiction over you in California on the basis that you do business there, that you will equally be doing business for the purpose of the law. So, we want to move on now. We talked about who is subject to the law and what kind of information is relevant. Then let's get into what do you actually have to do as an organization. Unlike some of the other privacy laws we've seen that get into your management of data more, the CCPA is solely a consumer protection statute. And the things that you have to do relate to the interactions you have with the consumer. So first of all, when you take in data, there is transparency that you have to provide to the consumer regarding what you are getting, where you are getting it from, and who you're going to send it to. And that includes both the third parties and the service providers. You do not have to list them by name. You have to list the categories of people with whom you share data and then whether that category is a third party or a service provider. That has to be provided at the point of collection. An important point here is that this law applies to both off and online data. So if information is being collected in a retail transaction, for example, notice has to be provided in some way in that retail transaction, not just on a website. The notice also has to provide the consumer with at least two methods for requesting more information, including a 1-800 number, which is a little bit interesting given that a lot of times this collection occurs over the web and consumers are only identified via a device ID. How that would play out if that person then called to ask a question about their data is a little bit interesting. All right, so the consumer now knows what you're going to do with the data. The consumer at any point can then come back to you and ask the organization to provide the specific pieces of information that it has collected about the consumer. Technically, there is a limitation that the organization only has to provide information that is collected in the last 12 months, but you see we've glossed over that here, and the reason for that is that in a lot of circumstances, it's going to be harder for an organization to figure out which pieces of data it collected in the last 12 months versus prior to that time period than it would be to just give the consumer all of the information that they've collected. The consumer also has the right to demand that the organization delete data that is about them. The right to deletion is a place where we're really uncertain as to what the consumer's actual right is under the statute. There's a number of obligations, including compliance with the legal obligation and security reasons. And then there's this final exception to enable solely internal uses that are reasonably aligned with the expectations of the consumer. And I think I could see different interpretations of that phrase, one in which basically no data ever gets deleted because so much use could be arguably within the business purpose of collecting the data, and another in which everything always has to get deleted because solely internal isn't really a thing in this day of interconnected computers and cloud computing, et cetera. If an organization is asked to delete data and they can't come up with an argument that one of those rights applies, the organization must also direct any service providers to whom it's passed the data to delete that data. They don't have to direct third parties to delete the data. Go on the next slide. Beyond access and erasure, the consumer also has the right to opt out. So at any time, the consumer can opt out from the sale of personal information. And it's important to note here that sale has an extremely broad meaning that is not limited to an organization sells its database to a third party for monetary value. Sale is basically any disclosure to an external party for monetary or other valuable consideration. And notably there, too, it doesn't say who receives the valuable consideration. So it isn't A discloses information and A receives consideration. It might be the other way around. A might be paying B to take that information for some purpose, and A is that's valuable consideration is trading hands, and therefore that's a sale of data. When a consumer has opted out of sale, the organization cannot ask them to opt back in for at least another 12 months. That's going to be a provision that is next to impossible to comply with from a technical perspective, given the way that website collection of data works. As I said earlier, often when somebody is on a website, the computer only knows them by their device ID. So number one, there's a challenge when that consumer then comes to the organization and says, show me what data you have about me. But there's an even bigger challenge when the consumer opts out, because if the consumer is only ever known by a device ID, there's really no way to prevent going back to that person and trying to place cookies, trying to collect more information, asking to get their information in the future. The opt-out right also requires that a company's website have a do not sell my personal information link. I think this is critical because even where privacy statements have already been updated for GDPR, the very specific requirements of the California law, including this particular link, the 800 number, there's also a requirement to categorize your data by the categories that are used in the definition of personal information, are going to require additional updates to a company's privacy policy. The opt-out right turns into an opt-in right if the person whose data is at issue is under 16 years of age. There's also a requirement that people who are going to be involved in handling consumer rights receive training from the company on what to do when these requests are received. Finally, the consumer has the right to not be discriminated against on the basis of having requested opt-out or exercised any of their rights under the CCPA. This is another provision of the law where it's really difficult to figure out what this means and what an organization is actually supposed to do in order to meet the obligations of the law. So the opt-out triggers a prohibition on discrimination, including denying goods or services, charging different prices, providing a different level of service, or suggesting that you will receive different level of service. However, an organization may charge a different price if the differential in price is reasonably related to the value of data. I'll preempt the question. I have no idea what that means. No one does. And the organization may offer a financial incentive for the collection of personal information so long as that's clearly disclosed and the consumer opts into the financial incentive. The big implication here, or the big question that a lot of organizations are going to face, is my loyalty program okay under this provision? Or is my offering one version of software for free with ads and offering a premium version okay? And I think where that starts is, well, is there a sale of information? Because if you're not selling information, then you don't have to worry about the discrimination against people who are opting out. If you are selling information, I think then you have to ask yourself a lot of questions about, do I need to sell the information? Is there any way to make this internal to reduce risk? If I can't do that, you know, how fair does this look to the consumer? I think we're really hopeful that there might be further guidance or rulemaking on this provision in the future because it's next to impossible to decipher from a couple paragraphs in the statute what these seemingly contradictory provisions mean. So What the additional facet of the California Consumer Privacy Law is that it creates a cause of action for a private plaintiff in the instance that there is a data breach. And here, the definition of personal information is not the definition that Alex read off earlier. It ties back to the California Data Breach Notification Statute, which has a heightened sensitivity to the data there. So it's first name or first initial and last name, along with financial account information, social security information, website account credentials, health information, things like that. If any of that information is inadvertently accessed outside the company, either through an intruder coming to the company and stealing it, or one of your employees accidentally sending an email to the wrong recipient, which I think we all know happens, you know, a lot more than anyone would like, that organization is going to face a class action for a data breach. There is no harm threshold for this class action, and there is a statutory damages provision of between $100 and $750 per consumer. That sounds like it's not a lot, and maybe in the case of an inadvertently forwarded email, it's not too bad. In the case of a large-scale data breach, those numbers can add up extremely quickly. And I think it's all but certain that an organization will face this lawsuit because there is a huge incentive for a class action plaintiff to just take them to court and see if the organization is willing to settle. The plaintiff would have to show that the breach occurred due to an organization's failure to implement reasonable security. Having said that, and I think this is on a later slide that I'm preempting, but there's no statutory definition to what reasonable security is, and so it will be on an organization to fight it out in court. The plaintiff's right of action only occurs where there is a data breach. Beyond that, only the California Attorney General can enforce the law. They can bring a civil action with a penalty of $2,500 per violation or $7,500 if the violation is intentional. And again, each individual consumer can constitute one violation, so those penalties can add up quickly.
All right. Thanks, Rachel. Before I get into the substance of this slide where we transition into looking at some comparisons with the GDPR, I wanted to answer a couple of questions that have come in and to read you the CLE code for New York. So that code for people who need New York CLE is 811-511. 811-511. And then we had a question, does the statute apply to a not-for-profit healthcare entity? No, if there is a no for-profit component, then it doesn't meet the definition of business. I would say that, you know, like the GDPR, even if you are not directly impacted by the law, it is a good idea to have an understanding of who is or whether there's another part of the organization that could be, because it does have a very broad definition. Another question was regarding the do not sell my personal information link. What are companies that don't sell personal information or personal data supposed to do? If you don't sell, then you don't need the link. And so, I'm sorry. Right, and so you need to say that in your privacy policy. So, you either have the link or you have the disclosure. Again, very important to remember that the definition of sale is extremely broad, basically disclosure for any kind of valuable consideration. So it requires a very close look. All right, so thank you for the continued questions. This is very good. Getting into the substance of this slide, we have listed a few issues, and we could list many, many more and get a lot more granular with this analysis. That gives you a sense of where the GDPR falls with respect to the CCPA. In general, the GDPR is a much more comprehensive statute in terms of regulating how companies organize data and how they protect data versus the CCPA that's very narrowly focused on disclosure and then certain consumer rights and kind of preventing broad disclosure of data outside of the relationship between the consumer and the business. And so a couple of things that I want to focus on here. First, notice. Notice under the GDPR is a bit more up to the discretion of the business in the way that it wants to present the way that it processes personal data versus the CCPA. You know, we already discussed the Do Not Share My Personal Information link. You have to have two methods for contact, one of which has to be a toll-free number. So to the extent that you don't have a phone number that people can call already, you need to set one up, and you need to have somebody who understands the CCPA obligations and what people may be calling about to staff that telephone line. You also need to be very specific in terms of the categories of personal information that you process. So the privacy disclosure, perhaps ironically, is going to become even more unwieldy than they may be already, because you need to take a look at the definition of personal information and then disclose, you know, how you process each of those categories of data. The other thing I want to point out here is service provider contracts. With the GDPR, you may be familiar with the controller processor concept, where if you, if factually speaking, you are engaged with a company that is a processor, you need to have a contract with them, and Article 28 of the GDPR has different elements that are required in that contract. Not so with the CCPA. It has a definition of service provider, but you're not obligated to set up that relationship. It has certain advantages if you do, but you don't have to. So it's going to be necessary to think about who your vendors are, who your service providers are, and making a conscious choice as to whether you want to amend those contracts to bring them within the definition of service provider. So as you can see, there are a few other things in here that I'm not going to touch on, but please feel free to ask more questions if you want to focus in on some of those elements. And then just to round out this discussion, you know, so, okay, Alex, what's the delta here? You know, if I need to be compliant with the GDPR and I also need to be compliant with the CCPA, and I've started to, doing GDPR compliance, what am I going to need to know? Well, you're going to need to revise any data mapping that you've done to align your CCPA compliance with the definition of personal information, because again, it is expanded. Arguably, some types of information that would not be personal data under the GDPR are personal information under the CCPA, and it's also necessary to account for those new elements of the definition in the CCPA, like information associated with a household and a data set that probabilistically identifies a person. As I just mentioned, you're going to have to revise privacy notices to establish the contact method and to be more specific about how you process personal information. You'll have to consider the effect of the opt-out and non-discrimination rights on your business model. The GDPR approaches opt-out and revocation of consent very differently than the CCPA. In fact, the CCPA doesn't have a concept of lawful basis of processing. It doesn't have consent, legitimate interest. It in fact does not prevent you from doing anything you want with personal information. The problem comes, or the issues come when you have to effectuate consumer rights, and the right to opt out is very powerful in that regard. So it's going to be necessary to understand, you know, does the opt-out apply? Where is there sale of information? And to deal with that relationship. And then finally, as I mentioned, whether processors are also going to meet the definition of service provider. Based on our preliminary look at this, it does not take too much to transform a data processing agreement into something that creates a business service provider relationship under the CCPA. But again, the main question there is whether you want to create that relationship or not.
So I want to dig a little bit into the impact of the CCPA on relationships where entities are sharing data. We'll go quickly through this because I know the reason you all are here is to hear about how we think people should handle this in 2019. And my rant about federal privacy legislation will take at least 19 minutes, so we'll go quickly. One thing that is going to cause a lot of consternation for companies is the fact that same-branded businesses may be viewed as one business under the CCPA, or in the reverse, may be viewed as a sale of information to which opt-out rights are going to come into play. So the definition of business, beyond including those three criteria that Alex talked about earlier, also says that entities that both share common branding and are controlled by or control another business are in fact one business. And this is a huge problem for opt-out rights where you have a corporate structure where entities don't necessarily share information or purposely try to segregate. Now, if the parent company in this situation gets a request for access to data, it has to go out to brand A and say, give me what you have as well. And any notice that it provides has to cover brand A. Similarly, if they're both the same business, brand A is going to have to give notice that covers the parent's collection of data or parent's receipt of information about consumers of brand A. If there's no control between two different affiliates, then you probably wouldn't have to extend that right. However, as you can see from this diagram, it can get really confusing, and you might be in a situation where if the request goes to the parent, they have three different affiliates that they have to go out and get information from, but if the request comes through an affiliate, there's only two entities that come into play. Organizations really will have to sit down with their org charts in advance of receiving consumer requests and figure out what are the places where we're going to have to go out and get that data if we get a request, and what are the places where it's actually a sale of data and the opt-out rights are going to apply. Similarly, the world is really confusing with regard to service providers, and we spent a lot of time on this already, so I'll go really quickly. But whether you're a service provider or a third party matters significantly under the CCPA. If you are a service provider, you do not have to deal with opt-out rights, and you do not have to deal with a lot of the other requirements of the CCPA. There was a question I saw that we skipped over about how does a service provider get around wanting to use information for its own purposes to improve its products or service. There's no magic bullet on that one. I think it's going to depend heavily on the context of the information. But if a business is wholesale handing data over to a service provider, that party is not going to be able to pick up that data and put it in a data set with other information related to that it receives from other businesses and still stay in the realm of service provider. I think there's some gray area where you can say the products or improvements that the service provider is doing are for the benefit of that business, but you have to be very careful to keep the data segregated. I think there's also going to be an interesting situation where your service provider is one such as a cloud provider where the employees or consumers of a business hit the servers, and the service provider is having to collect data directly for the purpose of the service provider's security. I think you run into some really sticky questions about whether that's the business's data, whether that's a separate piece of data. I don't think it would take you out of service provider territory to collect that data, because you could, I think, in that instance, structure the contract so these are two different activities. But you have to think really carefully about how that contract is structured, and the magic words have to be included in the contract for a service provider to fall into service provider territory. I won't walk through every line of this chart, but this is just to show you the different ways in which parties can come into contact with information and the rights that consumers have against each of those parties. You can see being a service provider gets you out of a whole lot. Technically, being a service provider gets you out of a private right of action. However, I can see a universe where businesses are asking service providers for indemnification if a data breach occurs at the side of the service provider. And I think it underscores the importance from the business perspective of having a robust vendor management program, because if there is a breach at the service provider, that business could be on the hook as the entity that collected the information. Security, we already touched on this in the private right of action, but their organizations basically have a requirement to implement reasonable security. There's no definition embedded in the statute, but the California AG has come out in the past and said the CIS Top 20 is a good place to start. And we've provided you for further reading some resources on the basics of reasonable security.
All right, so a few things on industry impact here and kind of gaming out how the CCPA might play out in different industries. I've listed just a few things here to kind of get you thinking about them. Obviously, there are many more industries. There are many more nuanced situations, especially with the definition of business encompassing or requiring companies to evaluate whether their subsidiaries are part of the business or not part of the business. So you know, as Rachel explained, you could have a corporate structure where the relationship between entities is that of a business provider and a third party, even though they're within the same corporate structure because of the definition of business. So it becomes very complicated very quickly. For cloud services, how are you supposed to identify individuals given the broad definition of personal information if you have a business that needs to search for that information? Are your search functions capable of finding that for them? How are you going to perform AI-based services? Going to the audience question earlier about use of data for your own purposes, it's unclear whether commingling data in a corpus that is supposed to train an AI permissible if you want to remain a service provider, because you're getting data from multiple sources and using it for presumably a different purpose. Companies with mixed data have to evaluate what data comes within the scope of the CCPA and what doesn't. For online behavioral advertising, this is a sort of rehash of the debate over OBA from the GDPR perspective. There's a lot of difficulty in implementing a system or understanding what to do when you have a third-party tracking provider, a beacon or a cookie dropped on a website publisher's website. At least initially, it looks as though the transfer of data between a website publisher and that third party, a Google Analytics, a Facebook Custom Audience, AppNexus, etc., is a sale of data because it's a transfer for consideration, and therefore subject to opt-out. Is that opt-out the same sort of thing that as under GDPR, or does it have different characteristics, and how do we deal with that? I think that'll be a major theme of compliance in 2019 because that's a main feature of so many websites. So there's a lot to talk about here, but I do want to move on to 2019 strategic planning, because that really is the foundation for being able to answer these questions for your business.
And I'll add, I know there's a bunch of questions we're glossing over right now. If we don't have time to get back and answer your question, feel free to reach out to Alex and I by email later today. So now for the question you've all been waiting for, do we really have to start complying with the California Consumer Privacy Act right now, or is something going to change? And our strong recommendation to you is to go ahead and start complying. There are two things that have been going on politically since the California law was signed. One is that we've seen a number of other states introduce copycat privacy legislation or talk about implementing a similar law in their own states. And probably as a result of that, the other thing that we've been seeing is renewed discussions at the federal level about whether a federal privacy law should be passed. For the first time, we're now seeing the tech industry actually lobby in favor of a federal privacy law because the tech industry is concerned about what might happen if there's one started in California and a slightly different law in Oregon and a different one in New York, et cetera. There have been some statements, you know, by members of the Senate who sit on the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee that, of course, we're going to do something and this law is inevitable. Having said that, there is no consensus amongst federal lawmakers as to what a federal privacy law would look like at this time. I've seen a number of analyses that say that the takeover of the House by the Democrats makes it more likely that a privacy law will be passed by Congress. I'm very skeptical of those analyses for the reason that you still have to get something through the Senate. We've seen absolutely no indication from Republicans that about what they would want to see in a privacy law or what would make them want to vote for it, or whether they would even be willing to prioritize that over other things on the legislative agenda. And we've seen no indication whatsoever from the executive branch regarding whether President Trump would be willing to sign such bill into law. So it's really, really difficult at this point to feel certain that federal law is going to come in and preempt California law and save the day. There's also a huge debate between the industry and between privacy advocates about whether federal law should be preemptive or whether federal law should just be a baseline. So even if we get federal law, we don't know whether or not California is still going to be in play. The other thing is that the basic requirements of California law are just not going away. And while there is some nuance and some reason to be concerned about differing obligations between states, the fact is that these fundamental principles of transparency, access, and consumer control underpin every discussion about policy. And even where industry associations or individual companies have put out their own policy statements or sets of policy principles, they all coalesce around these basic principles. The fact is, this is the new reality, and organizations aren't going to get out of things like having robust privacy statements, providing consumers with data upon request, or being aggressive about getting rid of personal information where it's no longer needed. The other reason not to wait out the federal legislation process is if for some reason that doesn't happen, or if it happens and the law goes into effect very quickly, the work that it's going to take to get compliant with California is going to take you many months, if not years, depending on your organization. And so we mentioned that unlike the GDPR, there's no requirement of a processing register, there's no requirement of data impact assessments, there's no requirement around safeguards or data minimization. Well, if you don't do those things, you're going to have a lot of difficulty complying with the specific consumer rights. And so you essentially do have to spend a lot of time on those requirements, particularly on data mapping. And in a complex organization, that could take months to complete. we've actually done some project planning for a couple clients, and Alex will go back to the numbers for a second. We've identified basically 21 different operational requirements that an organization has to achieve in order to be in compliance with the CCPA, and 68 individual tasks that they have to get through. That's a lot, and it's going to be really hard to get that done in a month if it gets to November or December of 2019 and federal law still hasn't come through.
And if I could interrupt for just a second, because I've been asked to read the New York Code again, so get ready for those who need the New York Code. It is 811-511. Thanks.
Great. Okay, so now that I've successfully convinced you all not to wait until next year to start thinking about California compliance, what should you be doing right now? And we've drawn a roadmap here that shows what the basic steps are in a compliance process. So number one, looking at the things that we've just described that you have to do, and where your organization is currently, and trying to identify where the particular gaps are and what pieces will take you the longest to get into compliance on. Number two is data and systems mapping. Cannot underestimate the importance of this. You have to know where your personal information is in order to provide notice about it, in order to provide access to it, and in order to secure it. And while you're there, this is a great opportunity to clean up your data, because the less data you have as an organization, the less things you have to give notice to, the less work you have to do to respond to consumer protocols, and the less risk there is that something will go wrong with regards to access to that data. The other thing that you are going to need in order to comply with California law is a robust information governance and security program. If you don't have procedures that allow for ongoing tracking and ongoing privacy assessments of your work, all of the great work that you do at the data and systems mapping stage is going to be out of date the day after you finish it, and you're going to have to go back in a year and spend a lot more money doing that again. Information governance procedures can also help with the minimization that I've mentioned and help you overall reduce your personal information footprint where that information is not providing value to the business to justify the expense of having to meet the requirements of privacy law. Once you've done that, you'll have to get into the stage of implementing consumer response protocols, thinking about how you're going to respond when you get these requests from consumers to access, erase, or opt out of their data. You're going to have to think very carefully about how you're going to intake those requests, and make sure that you've trained the people that are going to be involved in that process so that each request is responded to in a consistent way, and so all of the requirements of the law are met with regard to each request. And finally, you'll need to make sure that you've updated protocols throughout the company and provided training to employees who come into contact with personal information on the proper handling of that information. I go to the next slide. The things that you really need to do right now is the data mapping, the data management policy and procedure review, and the documentation of security controls. The reason to start these right now is twofold. One, it's that these are the things that take a lot of time and that are complicated and that are addressing the biggest areas of risk. And the other is that there's just no way that these are unquestionably going to be valuable to your organization no matter what the end scope of the requirement ends up being. You know, particularly on the security front, improving security is always a good idea, even if federal law ends up preempting the specific cause of action, your organization will be in a better place. There's a little bit of give and take on some of the remaining requirements. You could probably wait until the second half of next year to start thinking about consumer rights, to start thinking about your vendor management, and think about how you're going to verify consumer identity when you receive requests. You know, having said that, every compliance plan is going to have to be customized to your organization. And if you are already very mature in your vendor management, it'll be really easy for you at the end of 2019 to update your contracts according to the CCPA. If you are not mature, if you don't have a good sense of where your data is going, and your provisions are all over the map, you might want to start that before the end of 2019. Finally, there's a number of questions that organizations are going to have to answer as they work through their CCPA compliance efforts. And the answers to these are not straightforward, and it's really going to depend on your risk tolerance as an organization. First of all, organizations are going to have to figure out how they provide notice throughout the different ways in which consumers interact with the company. Again, the way we think about privacy policies right now is we tend to post them on our websites. But consumers interact with people in person in a lot of different areas, and somehow they will have to get notice if personal data is going to be collected. Products may need to change if they rely on consumer data, either because of the ability of consumers to demand that their data be erased in that product, to demand that their data be opted out of some process that goes on there, or the demand that say, or because the company can no longer offer some sort of discount to consumers to providing their information. Companies will have to think through how does that internal only exception apply, and where do they actually have to delete data versus where can they push back on the consumer. Another issue that's going to be really difficult for companies is how do you know that the person who's asking for a copy of their data is who they say they are? Because if you give data to the wrong person, well, then you've just inadvertently disclosed and you're going to be subject to some sort of private right of action. The Attorney General is instructed to issue regulations on the issue of identity verification. However, the consumer right goes into effect in January, and the Attorney General does not have to issue those regulations in July. So there's going to likely be a six-month period where organizations are flying blind and have to come up with some defensible way of verifying identity without guidance from the state. And then finally, organizations will have to think about unstructured data. This data can be really complicated when you're thinking about access requests and deletion requests because it's hard to find. And it's important to note as well that employees in California are consumers for the purposes of this law. Employees generate information that is personal information on a daily, if not by the minute basis, every time they send an email that has their contact information. And so organizations will have to figure out how do we satisfy this requirement without providing employees every email that they've ever sent while they've been employed by the company. With that, I know we're about to run over. Again, I apologize if there's questions that we didn't get to, but please feel free to reach out to myself or Alex. As you can tell, we really love talking about these topics, and we know that there's a lot of nuance that we weren't able to get into today. We'd welcome the opportunity to engage with some folks outside of the webinar.
Thank you, everybody.
A link to an online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.